it is now necessary that man, governed by his senses, should find in virtue a charm palpable to those senses. It is impossible to eradicate the passions, but we must strive to direct them to a noble aim. And it is therefore necessary that everyone should be able to satisfy his passions within the limits of virtue. Our order should provide means to that end. As soon as we have a certain number of worthy men in every state, each of them again training two others, and all being closely united, everything will be possible for our order, which has already, in secret, accomplished much for the welfare of mankind. This speech not only made a strong impression, but created excitement in the lodge. The majority of the brothers, seeing in it dangerous designs of illuminism, met it with a coldness that surprised Pierre. The Grand Master began answering him, and Pierre began developing his views with more and more warmth. It was long since there had been so stormy a meeting. Parties were formed, some accusing Pierre of illuminism, others supporting him. At that meeting he was struck for the first time by the endless variety of men's minds, which prevents a truth from ever presenting itself identically to two persons. Even those members who seemed to be on his side understood him in their own way, with limitations and alterations he could not agree to, as what he always wanted most was to convey his thought to others just as he himself understood it. At the end of the meeting, the Grand Master, with irony and ill will, reproved Bezúkhov for his vehemence, and said it was not love of virtue alone, but also a love of strife that had moved him in the dispute. Pierre did not answer him, and asked briefly whether his proposal would be accepted. He was told that it would not, and without waiting for the usual formalities, he left the lodge and went home. Again Pierre was overtaken by the depression he so dreaded. For 3 days after the delivery of his speech at the lodge, he lay on a sofa at home, receiving no one and going nowhere. Note, this incident recalls Tolstoy's own experience on the few occasions when he ventured to make a public speech, to him always a trying ordeal and one in which he had little success. It was just then that he received a letter from his wife, who implored him to see her, telling him how grieved she was about him and how she wished to devote her whole life to him. At the end of the letter, she informed him that in a few days she would return to Petersburg from abroad. Following this letter, one of the Masonic brothers, whom Pierre respected less than the others, forced his way in to see him, and, turning the conversation upon Pierre's matrimonial affairs, by way of fraternal advice, expressed the opinion that his severity to his wife was wrong, and that he was neglecting one of the first rules of Freemasonry by not forgiving the penitent. At the same time, his mother-in-law, Prince Vasily's wife, sent to him, imploring him to come, if only for a few minutes, to discuss a most important matter. Pierre saw that there was a conspiracy against him, and that they wanted to reunite him with his wife, and in the mood he then was, this was not even unpleasant to him. Nothing mattered to him. Nothing in life seemed to him of much importance, and under the influence of the depression that possessed him, he valued neither his liberty nor his resolution to punish his wife. No one is right and no one is to blame. So she too is not to blame, he thought. If he did not at once give his consent to a reunion with his wife, it was only because, in his state of depression, he did not feel able to take any step. Had his wife come to him, he would not have turned her away. Compared to what preoccupied him, was it not a matter of indifference whether he lived with his wife or not? Without replying either to his wife or his mother-in-law, Pierre, late one night, prepared for a journey and started for Moscow to see Joseph Alexeyevich. This is what he noted in his diary. Moscow, 17th November. I have just returned from my benefactor and hasten to write down what I have experienced. Joseph Alexeyevich is living poorly and has for 3 years been suffering from a painful disease of the bladder. No one has ever heard him utter a groan or a word of complaint. From morning to late at night, except when he eats his very plain food, he is working at science. He received me graciously and made me sit down on the bed on which he lay. I made the sign of the Knights of the East and of Jerusalem, and he responded in the same manner, asking me with a mild smile what I had learned and gained in the Prussian and Scottish lodges. Note, these Scottish Masonic lodges were not in Scotland. Certain German lodges were so called at that time. I told him everything as best I could, and told him what I had proposed to our Petersburg lodge, of the bad reception I had encountered, and of my rupture with the brothers. Joseph Alexeyevich, having remained silent and thoughtful for a good while, told me his view of the matter, which at once lit up for me my whole past and the future path I should follow. He surprised me by asking whether I remembered the threefold aim of the order: 1, the preservation and study of the mystery; 2, the purification and reformation of oneself for its reception; and 3, the improvement of the human race by striving for such purification. Which is the principal aim of these three? Certainly self-reformation and self-purification. Only to this aim can we always strive independently of circumstances. But at the same time, just this aim demands the greatest efforts of us. And so, led astray by pride, losing sight of this aim, we occupy ourselves either with the mystery which in our impurity we are unworthy to receive, or seek the reformation of the human race while ourselves setting an example of baseness and profligacy. Illuminism is not a pure doctrine just because it is attracted by social activity and puffed up by pride. On this ground, Joseph Alexeyevich condemned my speech and my whole activity, and in the depth of my soul, I agreed with him. Talking of my family affairs, he said to me, "The chief duty of a true Mason, as I have told you, lies in perfecting himself. We often think that by removing all the difficulties of our life, we shall more quickly reach our aim. But on the contrary, my dear sir, it is only in the midst of worldly cares that we can attain our three chief aims. 1, self-knowledge, for man can only know himself by comparison. 2, self-perfecting, which can only be attained by conflict. And 3, the attainment of the chief virtue, love of death. Only the vicissitudes of life can show us its vanity and develop our innate love of death or of rebirth to a new life." These words are all the more remarkable because, in spite of his great physical sufferings, Joseph Alexeyevich is never weary of life, though he loves death, for which, in spite of the purity and loftiness of his inner man, he does not yet feel himself sufficiently prepared. My benefactor then explained to me fully the meaning of the great square of creation, and pointed out to me that the numbers 3 and 7 are the basis of everything. He advised me not to avoid intercourse with the Petersburg brothers, but to take up only second-grade posts in the lodge, to try, while diverting the brothers from pride, to turn them toward the true path of self-knowledge and self-perfecting. Besides this, he advised me, for myself personally, above all, to keep a watch over myself, and to that end he gave me a notebook, the one I am now writing in, and in which I will in future note down all my actions. Petersburg, 23rd November. I am again living with my wife. My mother-in-law came to me in tears and said that Hélène was here and that she implored me to hear her, that she was innocent and unhappy at my desertion, and much more. I knew that if I once let myself see her, I should not have strength to go on refusing what she wanted. In my perplexity, I did not know whose aid and advice to seek. Had my benefactor been here, he would have told me what to do. I went to my room and reread Joseph Alexeyevich's letters and recalled my conversations with him, and deduced from it all that I ought not to refuse a suppliant, and ought to reach a helping hand to everyone, especially to one so closely bound to me, and that I must bear my cross. But if I forgive her for the sake of doing right, then let union with her have only a spiritual aim. That is what I decided, and what I wrote to Joseph Alexeyevich. I told my wife that I begged her to forget the past, to forgive me whatever wrong I may have done her, and that I had nothing to forgive. It gave me joy to tell her this. She need not know how hard it was for me to see her again. I have settled on the upper floor of this big house, and am experiencing a happy feeling of regeneration. Chapter 4. Hélène's social success. Her salon and relations with Boris. At that time, as always happens, the highest society that met at court and at the grand balls was divided into several circles, each with its own particular tone. The largest of these was the French circle of the Napoleonic Alliance, the circle of Count Rumyantsev and Caulaincourt. In this group, Hélène, as soon as she had settled in Petersburg with her husband, took a very prominent place. She was visited by the members of the French embassy, and by many belonging to that circle, and noted for their intellect and polished manners. Hélène had been at Erfurt during the famous meeting of the emperors, and had brought from there these connections with the Napoleonic notabilities. At Erfurt, her success had been brilliant. Napoleon himself had noticed her in the theatre and said of her, "C'est un superbe animal," that's a superb animal. Her success as a beautiful and elegant woman did not surprise Pierre, for she had become even handsomer than before. What did surprise him was that during these last 2 years his wife had succeeded in gaining the reputation d'une femme charmante aussi spirituelle que belle, of a charming woman as witty as she is lovely. The distinguished Prince de Ligne wrote her 8-page letters. Bilibin saved up his epigrams to produce them in Countess Bezukhova's presence. To be received in the Countess Bezukhova's salon was regarded as a diploma of intellect. Young men read books before attending Hélène's evenings to have something to say in her salon, and secretaries of the embassy and even ambassadors confided diplomatic secrets to her, so that, in a way, Hélène was a power. Pierre, who knew she was very stupid, sometimes attended, with a strange feeling of perplexity and fear, her evenings and dinner parties, where politics, poetry, and philosophy were discussed. At these parties, his feelings were like those of a conjurer who always expects his trick to be found out at any moment. But whether because stupidity was just what was needed to run such a salon, or because those who were deceived found pleasure in the deception, at any rate, it remained unexposed, and Hélène Bezukhova's reputation as a lovely and clever woman became so firmly established that she could say the emptiest and stupidest things, and yet everybody would go into raptures over every word of hers and look for a profound meaning in it of which she herself had no conception. Pierre was just the husband needed for a brilliant society woman. He was that absent-minded crank, a grand seigneur husband who was in no one's way, and far from spoiling the high tone and general impression of the drawing-room, he served, by the contrast he presented to her, as an advantageous background to his elegant and tactful wife. Pierre, during the last 2 years, as a result of his continual absorption in abstract interests and his sincere contempt for all else, had acquired in his wife's circle, which did not interest him, that air of unconcern, indifference, and benevolence toward all, which cannot be acquired artificially, and therefore inspires involuntary respect. He entered his wife's drawing-room as one enters a theatre, was acquainted with everybody, equally pleased to see everyone, and equally indifferent to them all. Sometimes he joined in a conversation which interested him, and, regardless of whether any gentlemen of the embassy were present or not, lispingly expressed his views, which were sometimes not at all in accord with the accepted tone of the moment. But the general opinion concerning the queer husband of the most distinguished woman in Petersburg was so well established that no one took his freaks seriously. Among the many young men who frequented her house every day, Boris Drubetskoy, who had already achieved great success in the service, was the most intimate friend of the Bezukhov household since Hélène's return from Erfurt. Hélène spoke of him as mon page, my page, and treated him like a child. Her smile for him was the same as for everybody, but sometimes that smile made Pierre uncomfortable. Toward him, Boris behaved with a particularly dignified and sad deference. This shade of deference also disturbed Pierre. He had suffered so painfully 3 years before from the mortification to which his wife had subjected him that he now protected himself from the danger of its repetition, first by not being a husband to his wife, and secondly by not allowing himself to suspect. Now that she has become a blue stocking, she has finally renounced her former infatuations, he told himself. There has never been an instance of a blue stocking being carried away by affairs of the heart. A statement which, though gathered from an unknown source, he believed implicitly. Yet, strange to say, Boris's presence in his wife's drawing room, and he was almost always there, had a physical effect upon Pierre. It constricted his limbs and destroyed the unconsciousness and freedom of his movements. What a strange antipathy, thought Pierre. Yet I used to like him very much. In the eyes of the world, Pierre was a great gentleman, the rather blind and absurd husband of a distinguished wife, a clever crank who did nothing but harmed nobody, and was a first-rate good-natured fellow. But a complex and difficult process of internal development was taking place all this time in Pierre's soul, revealing much to him and causing him many spiritual doubts and joys. Chapter 5. Pierre's Diary. Pierre went on with his diary, and this is what he wrote in it during that time. 24th November. Got up at 8, read the scriptures, then went to my duties. By Joseph Alexeyevich's advice, Pierre had entered the service of the state and served on one of the committees. Returned home for dinner and dined alone. The Countess had many visitors I do not like. I ate and drank moderately, and after dinner copied out some passages for the brothers. In the evening I went down to the Countess and told a funny story about B, and only remembered that I ought not to have done so when everybody laughed loudly at it. I'm going to bed with a happy and tranquil mind. Great God, help me to walk in thy paths. 1. To conquer anger by calmness and deliberation. 2. To vanquish lust by self-restraint and repulsion. 3. To withdraw from worldliness, but not avoid A. the service of the state, B. family duties, C. relations with my friends, and D. the management of my affairs. 27th November. I got up late. On waking, I lay long in bed, yielding to sloth. O God, help and strengthen me that I may walk in thy ways. Read the scriptures, but without proper feeling. Brother Urusov came, and we talked about worldly vanities. He told me of the emperor's new projects. I began to criticize them, but remembered my rules and my benefactor's words, that a true Freemason should be a zealous worker for the state when his aid is required, and a quiet onlooker when not called on to assist. My tongue is my enemy. Brothers G.V. and O. visited me, and we had a preliminary talk about the reception of a new brother. They laid on me the duty of Rita. I feel myself weak and unworthy. Then our talk turned to the interpretation of the 7 pillars and steps of the temple, the 7 sciences, the 7 virtues, the 7 vices, and the 7 gifts of the Holy Spirit. Brother O. was very eloquent. In the evening, the admission took place. The new decoration of the premises contributed much to the magnificence of the spectacle. It was Boris Drubetskoy who was admitted. I nominated him and was the Rita. A strange feeling agitated me all the time I was alone with him in the dark chamber. I caught myself harboring a feeling of hatred toward him, which I vainly tried to overcome. That is why I should really like to save him from evil and lead him into the path of truth. But evil thoughts of him did not leave me. It seemed to me that his object in entering the Brotherhood was merely to be intimate and in favor with members of our lodge. Apart from the fact that he had asked me several times whether N and S were members of our lodge, a question to which I could not reply, and that, according to my observation, he is incapable of feeling respect for our holy order, and is too preoccupied and satisfied with the outer man to desire spiritual improvement, I had no cause to doubt him. But he seemed to me insincere, and all the time I stood alone with him in the dark temple, it seemed to me that he was smiling contemptuously at my words, and I wished really to stab his bare breast with the sword I held to it. I could not be eloquent, nor could I frankly mention my doubts to the brothers and to the Grand Master. Great Architect of Nature, help me to find the true path out of the labyrinth of lies. After this, 3 pages were left blank in the diary, and then the following was written. I have had a long and instructive talk with Brother V, who advised me to hold fast by Brother A. Though I am unworthy, much was revealed to me. Adonai is the name of the creator of the world. Elohim is the name of the ruler of all. The third name is the name unutterable, which means the All. Talks with Brother V strengthen, refresh, and support me in the path of virtue. In his presence, doubt has no place. The distinction between the poor teachings of mundane science and our sacred, all-embracing teaching is clear to me. Human sciences dissect everything to comprehend it, and kill everything to examine it. In the holy science of our order, all is one. All is known in its entirety and life. The Trinity, the three elements of matter, are sulfur, mercury, and salt. Sulfur is of an oily and fiery nature. In combination with salt, by its fiery nature, it arouses a desire in the latter by means of which it attracts mercury, seizes it, holds it, and in combination produces other bodies. Mercury is a fluid, volatile, spiritual essence. Christ, the Holy Spirit, Him. 3rd December. Awoke late, read the scriptures, but was apathetic. Afterwards went and paced up and down the large hall. I wished to meditate, but instead, my imagination pictured an occurrence of 4 years ago when Dolokhov, meeting me in Moscow after our duel, said he hoped I was enjoying perfect peace of mind in spite of my wife's absence. At the time, I gave him no answer. Now I recalled every detail of that meeting, and in my mind gave him the most malevolent and bitter replies. I recollected myself and drove away that thought only when I found myself glowing with anger. But I did not sufficiently repent. Afterwards, Boris Drubetskoy came and began relating various adventures. His coming vexed me from the first, and I said something disagreeable to him. He replied. I flared up and said much that was unpleasant and even rude to him. He became silent, and I recollected myself only when it was too late. My God, I cannot get on with him at all. The cause of this is my egotism. I set myself above him, and so become much worse than he, for he is lenient to my rudeness, while I, on the contrary, nourish contempt for him. O God, grant that in his presence I may rather see my own vileness and behave so that he too may benefit. After dinner I fell asleep, and as I was drowsing off, I clearly heard a voice saying in my left ear, Thy day. I dreamed that I was walking in the dark and was suddenly surrounded by dogs, but I went on undismayed. Suddenly a smallish dog seized my left thigh with its teeth and would not let go. I began to throttle it with my hands. Scarcely had I torn it off before another, a bigger one, began biting me. I lifted it up, but the higher I lifted it, the bigger and heavier it grew. And suddenly Brother A came, and taking my arm, led me to a building, to enter which we had to pass along a narrow plank. I stepped on it, but it bent and gave way. and I began to clamber up a fence which I could scarcely reach with my hands. After much effort, I dragged myself up so that my legs hung down on one side and my body on the other. I looked round and saw Brother A standing on the fence and pointing me to a broad avenue and garden, and in the garden was a large and beautiful building. I woke up. O Lord, great architect of nature, help me to tear from myself these dogs, my passions, especially the last, which unites in itself the strength of all the former ones, and aid me to enter that temple of virtue, to a vision of which I attained in my dream. 7th December. I dreamed that Joseph Alexeyevich was sitting in my house, and that I was very glad and wished to entertain him. It seemed as if I chattered incessantly with other people, and suddenly remembered that this could not please him, and I wished to come close to him and embrace him, but as soon as I drew near, I saw that his face had changed and grown young, and he was quietly telling me something about the teaching of our order, but so softly that I could not hear it. Then it seemed to me that we all left the room, and something strange happened. We were sitting or lying on the floor. He was telling me something, and I wished to show him my sensibility, and not listening to what he was saying, I began picturing to myself the condition of my inner man and the grace of God sanctifying me. And tears came into my eyes, and I was glad that he noticed this. But he looked at me with vexation and jumped up, breaking off his remarks. I felt abashed and asked whether what he had been saying did not concern me, but he did not reply, gave me a kind look, and then we suddenly found ourselves in my bedroom where there is a double bed. He lay down on the edge of it, and I burned with longing to caress him and lie down too, and he said, "Tell me frankly what is your chief temptation. Do you know it? I think you know it already." Abashed by this question, I replied that sloth was my chief temptation. He shook his head incredulously, and even more abashed, I said that though I was living with my wife as he advised, I was not living with her as her husband. To this he replied that one should not deprive a wife of one's embraces, and gave me to understand that that was my duty, but I replied that I should be ashamed to do it. And suddenly, everything vanished, and I awoke and found in my mind the text from the Gospel, "The life was the light of men, and the light shineth in darkness, and the darkness comprehended it not." Joseph Alexeyevich's face had looked young and bright. That day I received a letter from my benefactor in which he wrote about conjugal duties. 9th December. I had a dream from which I awoke with a throbbing heart. I saw that I was in Moscow in my house in the big sitting room, and Joseph Alexeyevich came in from the drawing room. I seemed to know at once that the process of regeneration had already taken place in him, and I rushed to meet him. I embraced him and kissed his hands, and he said, "Hast thou noticed that my face is different?" I looked at him, still holding him in my arms, and saw that his face was young, but that he had no hair on his head, and his features were quite changed. And I said, "I should have known you had I met you by chance." And I thought to myself, "Am I telling the truth?" And suddenly I saw him lying like a dead body. Then he gradually recovered and went with me into my study, carrying a large book of sheets of drawing paper. I said, "I drew that," and he answered by bowing his head. I opened the book, and on all the pages there were excellent drawings, and in my dream I knew that these drawings represented the love adventures of the soul with its beloved, and on its pages I saw a beautiful representation of a maiden in transparent garments and with a transparent body flying up to the clouds, and I seemed to know that this maiden, was nothing else than a representation of the Song of Songs. And looking at those drawings, I dreamed I felt that I was doing wrong, but could not tear myself away from them. Lord, help me. My God, if thy forsaking me is thy doing, thy will be done. But if I am myself the cause, teach me what I should do. I shall perish of my debauchery if thou utterly desertest me. Chapter 6. The Rostovs in Petersburg. Berg engaged to Vera and demands her dowry. The Rostovs' monetary affairs had not improved during the 2 years they had spent in the country. Though Nicholas Rostov had kept firmly to his resolution and was still serving modestly in an obscure regiment, spending comparatively little, the way of life at Otradnoye, Mityenka's management of affairs in particular, was such that the debts inevitably increased every year. The only resource obviously presenting itself to the old count was to apply for an official post. So he had come to Petersburg to look for one, and also, as he said, to let the lassies enjoy themselves for the last time. Soon after their arrival in Petersburg, Berg proposed to Vera and was accepted. Though in Moscow the Rostovs belonged to the best society, without themselves giving it a thought, yet in Petersburg their circle of acquaintances was a mixed and indefinite one. In Petersburg they were provincials, and the very people they had entertained in Moscow without inquiring to what set they belonged, here looked down on them. The Rostovs lived in the same hospitable way in Petersburg as in Moscow, and the most diverse people met at their suppers. Country neighbors from Otradnoye, impoverished old squires and their daughters, Peronskaya, a maid of honor, Pierre Bezukhov, and the son of their district postmaster who had obtained a post in Petersburg. Among the men who very soon became frequent visitors at the Rostovs' house in Petersburg were Boris, Pierre, whom the count had met in the street and dragged home with him, and Berg, who spent whole days at the Rostovs' and paid the eldest daughter, Countess Vera, the attentions a young man pays when he intends to propose. Not in vain had Berg shown everybody his right hand wounded at Austerlitz and held a perfectly unnecessary sword in his left. He narrated that episode so persistently and with so important an air that everyone believed in the merit and usefulness of his deed, and he had obtained 2 decorations for Austerlitz. In the Finnish war, also, he managed to distinguish himself. He had picked up the scrap of a grenade that had killed an aide-de-camp standing near the commander-in-chief and had taken it to his commander. Just as he had done after Austerlitz, he related this occurrence at such length and so insistently that everyone again believed it had been necessary to do this, and he received 2 decorations for the Finnish war also. In 1809, he was a captain in the Guards, wore medals, and held some special lucrative posts in Petersburg. Though some skeptics smiled when told of Berg's merits, it could not be denied that he was a painstaking and brave officer, on excellent terms with his superiors, and a moral young man with a brilliant career before him and an assured position in society. 4 years before, meeting a German comrade in the stalls of a Moscow theater, Berg had pointed out Vera Rostova to him and had said in German, "Das soll mein Weib werden." That girl shall be my wife, and from that moment had made up his mind to marry her. Now in Petersburg, having considered the Rostovs' position and his own, he decided that the time had come to propose. Berg's proposal was at first received with a perplexity that was not flattering to him. At first it seemed strange that the son of an obscure Livonian gentleman should propose marriage to a Countess Rostova, but Berg's chief characteristic was such a naive and good-natured egotism that the Rostovs involuntarily came to think it would be a good thing, since he himself was so firmly convinced that it was good, indeed excellent. Moreover, the Rostovs' affairs were seriously embarrassed, as the suitor could not but know. And above all, Vera was 24, had been taken out everywhere, and though she was certainly good-looking and sensible, no one up to now had proposed to her. So they gave their consent. "You see," said Baird to his comrade, whom he called friend only because he knew that everybody has friends, "you see, I have considered it all, and should not marry if I had not thought it all out, or if it were in any way unsuitable. But on the contrary, my papa and mamma are now provided for. I have arranged that rent for them in the Baltic provinces." Note, throughout the 19th century, the Russian government, as a reward for service or simply by favoritism, used to make grants of rents, that is to say, the usufruct of land. "And I can live in Petersburg on my pay, and with her fortune and my good management we can get along nicely. I'm not marrying for money, I consider that dishonorable, but a wife should bring her share and a husband his. I have my position in the service, she has connections and some means. In our times, that is worth something, isn't it? But above all, she's a handsome, estimable girl, and she loves me." Berg blushed and smiled. "And I love her, because her character is sensible and very good. Now, the other sister, though they are the same family, is quite different, an unpleasant character, and has not the same intelligence. She's so, you know, unpleasant. But my fiancée, well, you will be coming..." He was going to say to dine, but changed his mind and said, "to take tea with us." And quickly doubling up his tongue, he blew a small round ring of tobacco smoke, perfectly embodying his dream of happiness. After the first feeling of perplexity aroused in the parents by Berg's proposal, the holiday tone of joyousness usual at such times took possession of the family. But the rejoicing was external and insincere. In the family's feeling toward this wedding, a certain awkwardness and constraint was evident, as if they were ashamed of not having loved Vera sufficiently and of being so ready to get her off their hands. The old count felt this most. He would probably have been unable to state the cause of his embarrassment, but it resulted from the state of his affairs. He did not know at all how much he had, what his debts amounted to, or what dowry he could give Vera. When his daughters were born, he had assigned to each of them for her dowry an estate with 300 serfs. But one of these estates had already been sold, and the other was mortgaged, and the interest so much in arrears that it would have to be sold, so that it was impossible to give it to Vera. Nor had he any money. Berg had already been engaged a month, and only a week remained before the wedding, but the count had not yet decided in his own mind the question of the dowry, nor spoken to his wife about it. At one time the count thought of giving her the Ryazan estate, or of selling a forest, at another time of borrowing money on a note of hand. A few days before the wedding, Berg entered the count's study early one morning, and with a pleasant smile respectfully asked his future father-in-law to let him know what Vera's dowry would be. The count was so disconcerted by this long-foreseen inquiry that, without consideration, he gave the first reply that came into his head. "I like your being businesslike about it. I like it. You shall be satisfied." And patting Berg on the shoulder, he got up, wishing to end the conversation. But Berg, smiling pleasantly, explained that if he did not know for certain how much Vera would have, and did not receive at least part of the dowry in advance, he would have to break matters off. "Because, consider, Count, if I allowed myself to marry now without having definite means to maintain my wife, I should be acting badly." The conversation ended by the Count, who wished to be generous and to avoid further importunity, saying that he would give a note of hand for 80,000 rubles. Berg smiled meekly, kissed the Count on the shoulder, and said that he was very grateful, but that it was impossible for him to arrange his new life without receiving 30,000 in ready money. "Or at least 20,000, Count," he added, "and then a note of hand for only 60,000. "Yes, yes, all right," said the Count heartedly. "Only excuse me, my dear fellow, I'll give you 20,000 and a note of hand for 80,000 as well. Yes, yes, sir. Kiss me." Chapter 7. Natasha and Boris. Natasha was 16, and it was the year 1809. the very year to which she had counted on her fingers with Boris after they had kissed 4 years ago. Since then, she had not seen him. Before Sonia and her mother, if Boris happened to be mentioned, she spoke quite freely of that episode as of some childish, long-forgotten matter that was not worth mentioning. But in the secret depths of her soul, the question whether her engagement to Boris was a jest or an important binding promise tormented her. Since Boris left Moscow in 1805 to join the army, he had not seen the Rostovs. He had been in Moscow several times and had passed near Otradnoye, but had never been to see them. Sometimes it occurred to Natasha that he did not wish to see her, and this conjecture was confirmed by the sad tone in which her elders spoke of him. "Nowadays old friends are not remembered," the Countess would say when Boris was mentioned. Anna Mikhailovna also had of late visited them less frequently, seemed to hold herself with particular dignity, and always spoke rapturously and gratefully of the merits of her son and the brilliant career on which he had entered. When the Rostovs came to Petersburg, Boris called on them. He drove to their house in some agitation. The memory of Natasha was his most poetic recollection, but he went with the firm intention of letting her and her parents feel that the childish relations between himself and Natasha could not be binding either on her or on him. He had a brilliant position in society, thanks to his intimacy with Countess Bezukhova, a brilliant position in the service, thanks to the patronage of an important personage whose complete confidence he enjoyed, and he was beginning to make plans for marrying one of the richest heiresses in Petersburg, plans which might very easily be realized. When he entered the Rostovs' drawing room, Natasha was in her own room. When she heard of his arrival, she almost ran into the drawing room, flushed and beaming with a more than cordial smile. Boris remembered Natasha in a short dress, with dark eyes shining from under her curls and boisterous childish laughter, as he had known her 4 years before, and so he was taken aback when quite a different Natasha entered, and his face expressed rapturous astonishment. This expression on his face pleased Natasha. "Well, do you recognize your little madcap playmate?" asked the Countess. Boris kissed Natasha's hand and said that he was astonished at the change in her. How handsome you've grown." "I should think so," replied Natasha's laughing eyes. "And is Papa older?" she asked. Natasha sat down, and without joining in Boris's conversation with the Countess, silently and minutely studied her childhood suitor. He felt the weight of that resolute and affectionate scrutiny and glanced at her occasionally. Boris's uniform, spurs, tie, and the way his hair was brushed were all comme il faut and in the latest fashion. This Natasha noticed at once. He sat rather sideways in the armchair next to the Countess, arranging with his right hand the cleanest of gloves that fitted his left hand like a skin, and he spoke with a particularly refined compression of his lips about the amusements of the highest Petersburg society, recalling with mild irony old times in Moscow and Moscow acquaintances. It was not accidentally, Natasha felt, that he alluded, when speaking of the highest aristocracy, to an ambassador's ball he had attended, and to invitations he had received from NN and SS. All this time, Natasha sat silent, glancing up at him from under her brows. This gaze disturbed and confused Boris more and more. He looked round more frequently toward her, and broke off in what he was saying. He did not stay more than 10 minutes, then rose and took his leave. The same inquisitive, challenging, and rather mocking eyes still looked at him. After his first visit, Boris said to himself that Natasha attracted him just as much as ever, but that he must not yield to that feeling, because to marry her, a girl almost without fortune, would mean ruin to his career, while to renew their former relations without intending to marry her would be dishonorable. Boris made up his mind to avoid meeting Natasha, but despite that resolution, he called again a few days later, and began calling often and spending whole days at the Rostovs. It seemed to him that he ought to have an explanation with Natasha and tell her that the old times must be forgotten, that in spite of everything, she could not be his wife, that he had no means, and they would never let her marry him. But he failed to do so, and felt awkward about entering on such an explanation. From day to day he became more and more entangled. It seemed to her mother and Sonia that Natasha was in love with Boris as of old. She sang him his favorite songs, showed him her album, making him write in it, did not allow him to allude to the past, letting it be understood how delightful was the present, and every day he went away in a fog without having said what he meant to, and not knowing what he was doing or why he came or how it would all end. He left off visiting Hélène and received reproachful notes from her every day, and yet he continued to spend whole days with the Rostovs. Chapter 8. Natasha's Bedtime Talks with Her Mother. One night, when the old countess, in nightcap and dressing jacket, without her false curls, and with her poor little knob of hair showing under her white cotton cap, knelt sighing and groaning on a rug and bowing to the ground in prayer, her door creaked, and Natasha, also in a dressing jacket, with slippers on her bare feet and her hair in curl papers, ran in. The countess, her prayerful mood dispelled, looked round and frowned. She was finishing her last prayer, "Can it be that this couch will be my grave?" Natasha, flushed and eager, seeing her mother in prayer, suddenly checked her rush, half sat down, and unconsciously put out her tongue as if chiding herself. Seeing that her mother was still praying, she ran on tiptoe to the bed, and rapidly slipping one little foot against the other, pushed off her slippers and jumped onto the bed the countess had feared might become her grave. This couch was high, with a feather bed and five pillows, each smaller than the one below. Natasha jumped on it, sank into the feather bed, rolled over to the wall, and began snuggling up the bedclothes as she settled down, raising her knees to her chin, kicking out and laughing almost inaudibly, now covering herself up head and all, and now peeping at her mother. The countess finished her prayers and came to the bed with a stern face, but seeing that Natasha's head was covered, she smiled in her kind, weak way.
Now then, said she. Mama, can we have a talk?
Yes, said Natasha.
Now, just one on your throat.
And another.
That'll do.
And seizing her mother round the neck, she kissed her on the throat. In her behavior to her mother, Natasha seemed rough, but she was so sensitive and tactful that, however she clasped her mother, she always managed to do it without hurting her or making her feel uncomfortable or displeased.
"Well, what is it tonight?" said the mother, having arranged her pillows, and waited until Natasha, after turning over a couple of times, had settled down beside her under the quilt, spread out her arms, and assumed a serious expression.
These visits of Natasha's at night before the Count returned from his club were one of the greatest pleasures of both mother and daughter.
"What is it tonight? But I have to tell you..."
Natasha put her hand on her mother's mouth.
"About Boris, I know," she said seriously. "That's what I've come about. Don't say it, I know." "No, do tell me."
And she removed her hand.
"Tell me, Mama. He's nice."
"Natasha, you're 16.
At your age, I was married.
You say Boris is nice.
He is very nice. And I love him like a son, but what then?"
"What are you thinking about? You've quite turned his head, I can see that."
As she said this, the countess looked round at her daughter. Natasha was lying looking steadily straight before her at one of the mahogany sphinxes carved on the corners of the bedstead, so that the countess only saw her daughter's face in profile. That face struck her by its peculiarly serious and concentrated expression. Natasha was listening and considering.
"Well, what then?" said she. "You've quite turned his head. And why? What do you want of him? You know you can't marry him."
"Why not?" said Natasha without changing her position.
"Because he's young, because he is poor, because he is a relation, and because you yourself don't love him."
"How do you know?"
"I know. It's not right, darling."
"But if I want to," said Natasha.
"Leave off talking nonsense," said the countess.
"But if I want to..."
"Natasha, I'm in earnest." Natasha did not let her finish. She drew the Countess's large hand to her, kissed it on the back and then on the palm, then again turned it over and began kissing first one knuckle, then the space between the knuckles, then the next knuckle, whispering, "January, February, March, April, May." "Speak, Mama. Why don't you say anything?" "Speak," said she, turning to her mother, who was tenderly gazing at her daughter, and in that contemplation seemed to have forgotten all she had wished to say. "It won't do, my love. Not everyone will understand this friendship dating from your childish days, and to see him so intimate with you may injure you in the eyes of other young men who visit us. And above all, it torments him for nothing. He may already have found a suitable and wealthy match, and now he's half crazy."
"Crazy?" repeated Natasha.
"I'll tell you some things about myself. I had a cousin, I know, Cyril Matveyevich, but he's old."
"He was not always old."
"But this is what I'll do, Natasha. I'll have a talk with Boris. He need not come so often."
"Why not, if he likes to?"
"Because I know it will end in nothing."
"How can you know?"
"No, Mama, don't speak to him."
"What nonsense,"
said Natasha, in the tone of one being deprived of her property.
"Well, I won't marry, but let him come if he enjoys it and I enjoy it."
Natasha smiled and looked at her mother.
Not to marry, but just so," she added.
"How so, my pet?"
"Well, just so. There's no need for me to marry him, but just so."
"Just so, just so," repeated the Countess, and shaking all over, she went off into a good-humored, unexpected, elderly laugh.
"Don't laugh, stop," cried Natasha. "You're shaking the whole bed. You're awfully like me, just such another giggler. Wait."
And she seized the Countess's hands and kissed a knuckle of the little finger, saying, "June," and continued kissing, "July, August, on the other hand."
"But, Mama, is he very much in love? What do you think? Was anybody ever so much in love with you? And he's very nice, very, very nice, only not quite my taste. He's so narrow, like the dining room clock. Don't you understand? Narrow, you know. Gray, light gray."
"Now, what rubbish are you talking?" said the Countess.
Natasha continued, "Don't you really understand? Nicholas would understand. Bezukhov now is blue, dark blue and red, and he is square."
"You flirt with him, too," said the Countess, laughing.
"No, he's a Freemason, I have found out. He's fine, dark blue and red. How can I explain it to you?"
"Little Countess," the Count's voice called from behind the door. "You're not asleep?" Natasha jumped up, snatched up her slippers, and ran barefoot to her own room. It was a long time before she could sleep. She kept thinking that no one could understand all that she understood and all there was in her. "Sonia," she thought, glancing at that curled-up, sleeping little kitten with her enormous plait of hair. "No, how could she? She's virtuous. She fell in love with Nicholas and does not wish to know anything more. Even Mama does not understand. It is wonderful how clever I am and how charming she is," she went on, speaking of herself in the third person, and imagining it was some very wise man, the wisest and best of men, who was saying it of her. "There is everything, everything in her," continued this man. "She's unusually intelligent, charming, and then she's pretty, uncommonly pretty, and agile. She swims and rides splendidly. And her voice, one can really say it's a wonderful voice." She hummed a scrap from her favorite opera by Cherubini, threw herself on her bed, laughed at the pleasant thought that she would immediately fall asleep, called Dunyasha the maid to put out the candle, and before Dunyasha had left the room, had already passed into yet another happier world of dreams, where everything was as light and beautiful as in reality, and even more so because it was different. Next day, the Countess called Boris aside and had a talk with him, after which he ceased coming to the Rostovs. Chapter 9. Natasha's first grand ball. She dances with Prince Andrew. On the 31st of December, New Year's Eve, 1809-10, an old grandee of Catherine's day was giving a ball and midnight supper. The diplomatic corps and the emperor himself were to be present. The grandee's well-known mansion on the English Quay glittered with innumerable lights. Police were stationed at the brightly lit entrance, which was carpeted with red baize, and not only gendarmes, but dozens of police officers and even the police master himself stood at the porch. Carriages kept driving away and fresh ones arriving, with red-liveried footmen and footmen in plumed hats. From the carriages emerged men wearing uniforms, stars, and ribbons, while ladies in satin and ermine cautiously descended the carriage steps, which were let down for them with a clatter, and then walked hurriedly and noiselessly over the baize at the entrance. Almost every time a new carriage drove up, a whisper ran through the crowd, and caps were doffed. The emperor? No, a minister. A prince? Ambassador? Don't you see the plumes? Was whispered among the crowd. One person, better dressed than the rest, seemed to know everyone, and mentioned by name the greatest dignitaries of the day. A third of the visitors had already arrived, but the Rostovs, who were to be present, were still hurrying to get dressed. There had been many discussions and preparations for this ball in the Rostov family, many fears that the invitation would not arrive, that the dresses would not be ready, or that something would not be arranged as it should be. Marya Ignatyevna Peronskaya, a thin and shallow maid of honor at the court of the Dowager Empress, who was a friend and relation of the Countess, and piloted the provincial Rostovs in Petersburg High Society, was to accompany them to the ball. They were to call for her at her house in the Taurida Gardens at 10 o'clock, but it was already 10:05, and the girls were not yet dressed. Natasha was going to her first grand ball. She had got up at 8 that morning, and had been in a fever of excitement and activity all day. All her powers since morning had been concentrated on ensuring that they all, she herself, Mama, and Sonya, should be as well dressed as possible. Sonya and her mother put themselves entirely in her hands. The Countess was to wear a claret-colored velvet dress, and the two girls white gauze over pink silk slips, with roses on their bodices, and their hair dressed à la grecque. Everything essential had already been done. Feet, hands, necks, and ears washed, perfumed, and powdered, as befits a ball. The open-work silk stockings and white satin shoes with ribbons were already on. The hairdressing was almost done. Sonya was finishing dressing, and so was the Countess, but Natasha, who had bustled about helping them all, was behindhand. She was still sitting before a looking-glass with a dressing jacket thrown over her slender shoulders. Sonya stood ready, dressed, in the middle of the room, and, pressing the head of a pin till it hurt her dainty finger, was fixing on a last ribbon that squeaked as the pin went through it. "That's not the way! That's not the way, Sonya!" cried Natasha, turning her head and clutching with both hands at her hair, which the maid who was dressing it had not time to release. "That bow is not right. Come here!" Sonya sat down, and Natasha pinned the ribbon on differently.
"Allow me, miss, I can't do it like that," said the maid who was holding Natasha's hair. "Oh, dear. Well, then, wait. That's right, Sonya."
"Aren't you ready? It is nearly 10," came the Countess's voice. "Directly, directly. And you, Mama?"
"I have only my cap to pin on."
"Don't do it without me," called Natasha. "You won't do it right."
"But it's already 10."
They had decided to be at the ball by 10:30. And Natasha had still to get dressed, and they had to call at the Taurida Gardens. When her hair was done, Natasha, in her short petticoat, from under which her dancing shoes showed, and in her mother's dressing jacket, ran up to Sonya, scrutinized her, and then ran to her mother. Turning her mother's head this way and that, she fastened on the cap, and hurriedly kissing her gray hair, ran back to the maids who were turning up the hem of her skirt. The cause of the delay was Natasha's skirt, which was too long. Two maids were turning up the hem and hurriedly biting off the ends of thread. A third, with pins in her mouth, was running about between the Countess and Sonya, and a fourth held the whole of the gossamer garment up high on one uplifted hand.
"Mavra, quicker, darling. Give me my thimble, miss, from there."
"Whenever will you be ready?" asked the Count, coming to the door.
"Here is some scent. Pieronska, you must be tired of waiting."
"It's ready, miss," said the maid, holding up the shortened gauze dress with two fingers, and blowing and shaking something off it, as if by this to express a consciousness of the airiness and purity of what she held. Natasha began putting on the dress.
"In a minute, in a minute. Don't come in, Papa," she cried to her father as he opened the door,
speaking from under the filmy skirt which still covered her whole face. Sonya slammed the door to. A minute later, they let the Count in. He was wearing a blue swallowtail coat, shoes, and stockings, and was perfumed and his hair pomaded.
"Oh, Papa, how nice you look! Charming!" cried Natasha, as she stood in the middle of the room, smoothing out the folds of the gauze. "If you please, miss, allow me," said the maid, who on her knees was pulling the skirt straight and shifting the pins from one side of her mouth to the other with her tongue.
"Say what you like," exclaimed Sonya in a despairing voice as she looked at Natasha. "Say what you like, it's still too long."
Natasha stepped back to look at herself in the pier glass. The dress was too long.
"Really, madam, it is not at all too long," said Mavra, crawling on her knees after her young lady. "Well, if it's too long, we'll take it up. We'll tack it up in 1 minute," said the resolute Dunyasha, taking a needle that was stuck on the front of a little shawl, and still kneeling on the floor, set to work once more.
At that moment, with soft steps, the Countess came in shyly in her cap and velvet gown.
"Oh, my beauty!" exclaimed the Count. "She looks better than any of you."
He would have embraced her, but blushing, she stepped aside, fearing to be rumpled.
"Mama, your cap, more to this side," said Natasha. I'll arrange it."
And she rushed forward so that the maids who were tacking up her skirt could not move fast enough, and a piece of gauze was torn off.
"Oh, goodness, what has happened? Really, it was not my fault."
"Never mind, I'll run it up. It won't show," said Dunyasha.
"What a beauty! A very queen," said the nurse as she came to the door. "And Sonya, they are lovely."
At 10:15, they at last got into their carriages and started, but they had still to call at the Taurida Gardens. Pieronskaya was quite ready. In spite of her age and plainness, she had gone through the same process as the Rostovs, but with less flurry, for to her it was a matter of routine. Her ugly old body was washed, perfumed, and powdered in just the same way. She had washed behind her ears just as carefully, and when she entered her drawing-room in her yellow dress, wearing her badge as maid of honor, her old lady's maid was as full of rapturous admiration as the Rostovs' servants had been. She praised the Rostovs' toilets. They praised her taste and toilet, and at 11:00, careful of their coiffures and dresses, they settled themselves in their carriages and drove off. Natasha had not had a moment free since early morning, and had not once had time to think of what lay before her. In the damp, chill air and crowded closeness of the swaying carriage, she for the first time vividly imagined what was in store for her there at the ball, in those brightly lighted rooms, with music, flowers, dances, the Emperor, and all the brilliant young people of Petersburg. The prospect was so splendid that she hardly believed it would come true. So out of keeping was it with the chill darkness and closeness of the carriage. She understood all that awaited her only when, after stepping over the red baize at the entrance, she entered the hall, took off her fur cloak, and beside Sonya and in front of her mother, mounted the brightly illuminated stairs between the flowers. Only then did she remember how she must behave at a ball, and tried to assume the majestic air she considered indispensable for a girl on such an occasion. But, fortunately for her, she felt her eyes growing misty. She saw nothing clearly. Her pulse beat 100 to the minute, and the blood throbbed at her heart. She could not assume that pose, which would have made her ridiculous, and she moved on, almost fainting from excitement and trying with all her might to conceal it. And this was the very attitude that became her best. Before and behind them, other visitors were entering, also talking in low tones and wearing ball dresses. The mirrors on the landing reflected ladies in white, pale blue, and pink dresses, with diamonds and pearls on their bare necks and arms. Natasha looked in the mirrors and could not distinguish her reflection from the others. All was blended into one brilliant procession. On entering the ballroom, the regular hum of voices, footsteps, and greetings deafened Natasha, and the light and glitter dazzled her still more. The host and hostess, who had already been standing at the door for half an hour, repeating the same words to the various arrivals, "Charmé de vous voir," delighted to see you, greeted the Rostovs and Peronskaya in the same manner. The two girls in their white dresses, each with a rose in her black hair, both curtsied in the same way, but the hostess's eye involuntarily rested longer on the slim Natasha. She looked at her and gave her alone a special smile, in addition to her usual smile as hostess. Looking at her, she may have recalled the golden, irrecoverable days of her own girlhood and her own first ball. The host also followed Natasha with his eyes and asked the Count which was his daughter. "Charming," said he, kissing the tips of his fingers. In the ballroom, guests stood crowding at the entrance doors, awaiting the Emperor. The Countess took up a position in one of the front rows of that crowd. Natasha heard and felt that several people were asking about her and looking at her. She realized that those noticing her liked her, and this observation helped to calm her. "There are some like ourselves and some worse," she thought. Pironskaya was pointing out to the Countess the most important people at the ball. "That is the Dutch ambassador, do you see? That gray-haired man," she said, indicating an old man with a profusion of silver-gray curly hair who was surrounded by ladies laughing at something he said. "Ah, here she is, the Queen of Petersburg, Countess Bezukhova," said Peronskaya, indicating Hélène, who had just entered. "How lovely! She's quite equal to Maria Antonovna. See how the men, young and old, pay court to her. Beautiful and clever. They say Prince Blank is quite mad about her. But see, those two, though not good-looking, are even more run after." She pointed to a lady who was crossing the room, followed by a very plain daughter. "She is a splendid match, a millionairess," said Pironskaya. "And look, here come her suitors." "That is Bezukhova's brother, Anatole Kuragin," she said, indicating a handsome officer of the horse guards who passed by them with head erect, looking at something over the heads of the ladies. "He's handsome, isn't he? I hear they will marry him to that rich girl. But your cousin Drubetskoy is also very attentive to her. They say she has millions." "Oh, yes, that's the French ambassador himself," she replied to the Countess's inquiry about Caulaincourt. "Looks as if he were a king. All the same, the French are charming, very charming. No one more charming in society. Ah, here she is. Yes, she's still the most beautiful of them all, our Maria Antonovna. And how simply she is dressed. Lovely. And that stout one in spectacles is the universal Freemason," she went on, indicating Pierre. "Put him beside his wife, and he looks a regular buffoon." Pierre, swaying his stout body, advanced, making way through the crowd, and nodding to right and left, as casually and good-naturedly as if he were passing through a crowd at a fair. He pushed through, evidently looking for someone. Natasha looked joyfully at the familiar face of Pierre, the buffoon, as Peronskaya had called him, and knew he was looking for them, and for her in particular. He had promised to be at the ball and introduce partners to her. But before he reached them, Pierre stopped beside a very handsome, dark man of middle height and in a white uniform, who stood by a window talking to a tall man wearing stars and a ribbon. Natasha at once recognized the shorter and younger man in the white uniform. It was Bolkonski, who seemed to her to have grown much younger, happier, and better looking. "There's someone else we know. Bolkonski, do you see, Mama?" said Natasha, pointing out Prince Andrew. "You remember, he stayed a night with us at Otradnoye." "Oh, you know him?" said Pironskaya. "I can't bear him. Il fait à présent la pluie et le beau temps. He's all the rage just now. He's too proud for anything. Takes after his father. And he's hand in glove with Speransky,
writing some project or other. Just look how he treats the ladies. There's one talking to him, and he is turned away, she said, pointing at him. I'd give it to him if he treated me as he does those ladies.
Suddenly, everybody stirred, began talking, and pressed forward and then back. And between the two rows, which separated, the emperor entered to the sounds of music that had immediately struck up. Behind him walked his host and hostess. He walked in rapidly, bowing to right and left, as if anxious to get the first moments of the reception over. The band played the polonaise in vogue at that time on account of the words that had been set to it, beginning, Alexander, Yelizaveta, all our hearts you ravish quite. The emperor passed on to the drawing room. The crowd made a rush for the doors, and several persons with excited faces hurried there and back again. Then the crowd hastily retired from the drawing room door, at which the emperor reappeared talking to the hostess. A young man, looking distraught, pounced down on the ladies, asking them to move aside. Some ladies, with faces betraying complete forgetfulness of all the rules of decorum, pushed forward to the detriment of their toilets. The men began to choose partners and take their places for the polonaise. Everyone moved back, and the emperor came smiling out of the drawing room, leading his hostess by the hand, but not keeping time to the music. The host followed with Maria Antonovna Naryshkina. Then came ambassadors, ministers, and various generals, whom Peronskaya diligently named. More than half the ladies already had partners and were taking up or preparing to take up their positions for the polonaise. Natasha felt that she would be left with her mother and Sonia among a minority of women who crowded near the wall, not having been invited to dance. She stood with her slender arms hanging down, her scarcely defined bosom rising and falling regularly, and with bated breath and glittering, frightened eyes, gazed straight before her, evidently prepared for the height of joy or misery. She was not concerned about the emperor or any of those great people whom Peronskaya was pointing out. She had but one thought. Is it possible no one will ask me, that I shall not be among the first to dance? Is it possible that not one of all these men will notice me? They do not even seem to see me. Or if they do, they look as if they were saying, ah, she's not the one I'm after, so it's not worth looking at her. No, it's impossible, she thought,